You're not supposed to start talks with apologies, but I really feel apologetic that I haven't included what is increasingly one of my favourite and one of the most important stories in here, which is the story of when Jesus appears to Mary. You may notice he jumped from verse 10 to verse 19, mainly because he wanted to look at Thomas, who is the patron saint of skeptics. But to have left out Mary feels like it feels as if the feminists are right, they've been written out of history. But it's purely due to time. And I'm sorry about that, because it is one of the remarkable things that the early Christians insist on writing in their texts, which is that the first witnesses of the resurrection were women, which if you know anything about the culture is an absurd thing to make up. You would never make that up. But I've left it out. My apologies. You can read it for yourself. Now, I mentioned a couple of weeks ago the great boxer, Muhammad Ali, with his interest in the resurrection of Jesus. But the other guy who's quite different is a guy from London University called Professor C.E.M. Job, who was a great philosopher in the middle of the 20th century. And he was asked once if he could have dinner with anyone and ask them any question, who would it be? I like these sort of questions. He wrote this: I would like to have dinner with Jesus, and I would like to ask him the most important question in the world. Did you or did you not rise from the dead? Now, it's interesting. I mean, why would that be? This man is no fool. He wrote a number of impressive books. Why would you consider that the question for Jesus, did he or did he not rise from the dead, would be the most important question in the world? I think it's hard for us to realise that something very peculiar and very powerful happened in Jerusalem around about 33 AD. We just don't seem to realise what a bizarre thing it is. Buddha had decades to set up his thing. Muhammad had decades. Jesus had a bit less than 3 years. And it finished with his demise, where he was crushed by the Romans, thus proving that he was not the Christ, as far as most Jews are concerned. And yet Christianity exploded out of Jerusalem with an energy and a joy and a passion that was unstoppable, even though, unlike, for example, Islam, and this is not a root con at Islam, Islam grew for the first couple of hundred years under and behind magnificent armies. Christianity grew for the first 300 years, being crushed by the most impressive military force the earth had seen till that time. Something quite extraordinary happened. Now, the question for us is to think about, well, what might that be? The rumour is that it's got to do with a man who defeated death. Now, again, that's rarer than you think. Death defeats everybody. Death has the last word and the last laugh on great religious leaders. Think of any of the ones you want to name. They all finish their life at death. Great political leaders, great humanitarians, they all finish with death. Death always has the last word. You can read articles in the Woman's Weekly and other things like that about people who defeated death or cheated death. That's always nonsense. You avoid death for a minute, but in the end death will swallow you up and destroy you. The notion that a man actually defeated death is significant, although we do need to be sceptical. Skepticism, which is part of the title today that I was given, skepticism, I think, is an entirely sensible, healthy, thoroughly Christian point of view. Skepticism takes the view that the world is full of liars, that the world is full of deceivers, particularly when money's involved. Right? Anyone who wants to preach religion of any sort and then asks for money, or particularly up front, if your sceptical alert is not ringing real loud, you've never seen movies about America. Yeah. But you see, scepticism basically works on this idea that every new idea, particularly strange ideas, needs to be well supported by evidence. And even if it's a nice idea, what's the evidence? That is an entirely Christian point of view. Now, because of the work of a guy called Immanuel Kant back hundreds and hundreds of years ago, the West, that is the European tradition of thought, has pretty much lost that idea. It thinks that Christianity and faith are contrary to scepticism. That in terms of classical, ordinary, mainline Christianity is complete nonsense. Christianity is entirely in agreement with the need to be sceptical. You want good evidence to believe things. You need it. And that's why I think poor old Thomas is dealt with badly. He's not doubting Thomas. He doesn't doubt. doubts when you're not quite sure. He's absolutely certain that he didn't rise from the dead, then he's absolutely certain he did rise from the dead. He's not doubting at all. And he's no worse than any of the other disciples. Because although John doesn't record it, Luke records the fact that when Mary and the women came back saying that they had seen Jesus, the other disciples mocked them. Stupid, hysterical women. Right? Can't cope with death. Right? As if it's bad enough dealing with death, now we've got to deal with your insanity. They didn't believe it. So the only reason that the first disciples believed before Thomas, as you heard read, was because they saw what Thomas hadn't seen. Now lastly, before we actually look at the verses themselves briefly, the idea that God should raise someone from the dead is not all that hard to believe. Once you're open to the possibility that there's a God. In fact, Peter Slezak, who's one of Australia's more thoughtful atheists, and we organised a big debate with him and a few guys in Sydney some years ago. And Peter Slezak is on record as saying this: for a God who made the universe, the raising of the dead is child's play. And I think that's fair to say. Once you believe that there even might possibly be a God, which is about as sceptical as most atheists are, you've really got to say, well, resurrection is at least a possibility. But you'd want to, it's rare, and what's interesting is the claims for it are rare, particularly around real historical people. So let's have a look at this, the skeptic, what the skeptic saw. Well, firstly, what the skeptic Thomas did not see. The part that I've left out, and I'm feeling worse and worse the more I think about that, he didn't see what Mary saw. Mary saw Jesus. She comes back to the disciples and says, "I have seen the Lord." She does not come back with a theological statement. She doesn't come back with some philosophical view about how life can triumph over death, love over evil. Then she just says a fact, "I've seen him." Then as you heard, the disciples, Jesus turns up, and at verse 19 that you've got there, on the evening of the first day of the week when the disciples were together with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders. That's not an anti-Jewish statement. That's just the fact that if the way that organisations, institutions and governments work is that when you chop off the head of a revolutionary movement, you normally come to sort of mop up the other troublemakers and put them in prison at least. So they're expecting that they'll be next after Jesus has been killed. Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Well, might he say, "Peace be with you," because they wouldn't have been feeling much peace. After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side. Now, what do you think about that? Jesus showed them his hands and his side. The significance of that, if you read it in the chapter before, you know that his hands were where he was nailed up to the tree. And John records the fact that the Roman soldiers were surprised that Jesus had died quite as quickly as he did. So just to make sure, they shoved a spear up into his side. And what came up was what looked like blood and water, John tells us. So he actually says, "Have a look. There's the mark of the nail. Here's where the spear went in." What's he doing there? See, and I don't want to take a cheap shot at Richard Dawkins, although he's a master of cheap shots. I don't want to take a cheap shot at him. He's not here to defend himself. But he is on record a number of times having said that faith is contrary to evidence. In fact, he says, the less evidence there is, the better the faith. Now, he can define faith like that if he wants to, but it's just not the way the Bible does. And he's been publicly, not publicly, he's been in public debates and in letters from other Oxford professors that he's been told that's a nonsense definition of faith. But he likes it because it's self-evidently stupid. But what Jesus does is he shows them the evidence. He's not saying, "Cut off your brains, boys, and believe in stuff that's nice to believe." He says, "Look, it really is me. See? And here's where the spear went. That was not done to everyone who was crucified." So Jesus, he's an empiricist at that level. That is, he's like John Locke. He's a scientific. He's saying, you need evidence. You need to be assured that it really is me. It's not my twin who's come back from India after a long holiday or something like that. I mean, as one guy tragically has argued in the last couple of years, trying to find some explanation for this. But anyhow, so he moves on. So Thomas didn't see what Mary saw. Thomas didn't see what the other disciple. I don't know where he was. My hunch is when the women came back with the message, he went for a walk. I think that's pure speculation. He just went for a walk. He'd had enough of hanging around with the guys, being depressed, and now with all these crazy stories going on. So he goes for a stroll. He comes back and the disciples have completely stolen Mary's sermon. She said, I've seen the Lord. They say in verse 24, now Thomas, also known as Didymus, or the twin, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciples told him, we have seen the Lord. So she said, I have seen the Lord. They say, we have seen the Lord. So, what does Thomas know he's not going to see? The next verse will tell you. But Thomas said to them, unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. I want to suggest to you that Thomas does not expect this to happen.
This is like saying, you know, when Souths win the premiership, oh, I can't do that, that's a rugby league illustration, can I?
It's just something, he's not expecting that he's going to get a chance to stick his fingers. He knows dead people don't come back from the dead. He's just saying, it ain't going to happen. Unless I stick my finger, maybe the emphasis on the word I. You know, you've all seen your little, unless I can stick my finger, stick my hand in the side, I won't believe. So he's very clear on what he thinks he won't see. Now what I think is really interesting, I have no idea why this is the case, but it's fascinating, is verse 26. Having expressed the beautiful sceptical view, I want good evidence. Jesus leaves them, verse 26, for a week. So that, I just find it interesting that Jesus doesn't turn up that night. He leaves them for a week. Wrestling with Thomas. My own hunch, the Ian Powell hunch, for what it's worth, which is not much. I imagine he's getting them used to the idea of trying to convince people that he's risen from the dead. On a relatively easy guy, one of their friends that they've been with for 3 years. One of the guys who's seen all the miracles Jesus has done. Fairly easy going, you would have thought. So they have a week of arguments, backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards. Thomas not being convinced. And then Jesus turns up a week later. Goes straight over to Thomas. Verse 27, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it at my side, stop doubting and believe. Stop unbelieving and believe is what it is. So in the end, Thomas sees what he didn't expect to see. And again, I want to draw your attention to the way in which Jesus understands how a person comes to faith. They do not come to faith by not looking at evidence. They come to faith by looking at the evidence. You trust the trustworthy. You believe the believable. You depend on the dependable. To do anything other than that is just stupid. And it's not what the Bible says. He hasn't given us a brain to not use it in the most important part of life. This skeptic is not a dogmatic, bigoted skeptic. Skepticism is good, where it says, I will not believe that until there's good evidence, until there's good reason to believe. But some skepticism is just a dogmatic, bigoted skepticism, and really says it doesn't matter what evidence you bring, I'll never believe it. And it's disguised between an open mind seeking better evidence. Now the problem for you and me is we don't live in the right country and we don't live at the right time to have been able to see and believe. See, it's said very clearly in verse 10, I think it is, that John saw and he believed. And there are times when seeing is believing. You heard that expression, seeing is believing? It's a nonsense expression often. If people say, I only believe what I see, they haven't thought enough. Because you can have fun, it's just cheeky fun. You can say, hang on, before we continue this discussion, I want to make sure you have a brain. And since we only believe what we see, can I just open your head up? And make sure there's a brain so I'm not wasting any. You say, well, look, but you can see what the brain does. Yes, yes. There's all sorts of things you don't see, but you see the results of it. In fact, probably a huge percentage of reality is invisible to us. Now, seeing is believing sometimes. But there's an awful lot of stuff that you believe in that you don't see, you can't see, you won't ever see. I don't have any doubt, for example, that the Holocaust happened. I don't have any doubt that white fellas arrived in Australia 200 years ago. You could argue that we've always been here, couldn't you? Did you see? No, you didn't see. All sorts of things about your childhood, your parentage, etc. You didn't see it. So seeing is believing sometimes. You've got to work out what's the appropriate evidence. For Thomas, for the first disciples, seeing was believing. And in fact, it's very interesting as Jesus builds what is clearly the platform for this explosion that happens in Jerusalem. The very next book, the book of Acts, chapter 1, verse 3, says this: after Jesus' suffering, he presented himself to them and gave many convincing proofs that he was alive. See, that just one of the helpful phrases that the Bible uses, many convincing proofs that he was alive. See, this is empiricism. This is skepticism. It's saying you need proofs. The first witnesses needed proofs. We, on the other hand, the way in which the realities of time and space work out, we simply cannot be in every space at every time. That's just not the way in which the universe works. So how can we come to believe stuff that we have not seen? Well, the verses go on beyond what you've got there, where it says this in verse 30. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. So John's just saying, I haven't written down everything Jesus did. But these are written so that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and by believing you may have life in his name. John's very clear. The people to be really suspicious of are the people who say, I have no agenda in making this documentary. I'm just interested in the facts. Those sorts of people you want to be real suspicious of, because I've read books written by people who made BBC documentaries saying exactly that. I remember this man, I'd read a book by him, and he was doing this documentary on Jesus, and he was an interesting scholar from England, saying in front of one of those ivy-leafed beautiful old buildings in England, now of course we're not interested here in dogma or beliefs or philosophy, just what really happened, and that's what I'm going to tell you, just the facts. I thought, you dog, because he has a very strong view which came out entirely in his thing, very peculiar view. The great thing with John is he doesn't say, I don't have a bias. He says, I'm persuaded that Jesus is the Son of God, and I'm going to give you the evidence so you can know too. It's exactly what you expect in scientific papers, isn't it? Right? Who's allowed to convince you that the world is round? Someone who thinks the world is flat. You say to someone who thinks the world is round, no, you're biased. Of course he's biased. Let him share with you the information that has convinced him. That's what the Gospels are. John, eyewitness, and he says, I want you to believe what I believe, therefore I've written it down. So you are one generation away. So John will tell you what he saw. You seem like a long way away, but you're not. That's how far away you are. The last thing before I finish is that what Thomas says when he sees Jesus, interestingly, he doesn't stick his finger in the holes. He's invited to. There's no evidence that he did. He might have, but I think we'd have been told if he did. Jesus says, come on, buddy, if that's what you need, do it. Just for goodness sake, believe what's true. And Thomas, though, says, my Lord and my God. So he sees through the event to the final conclusion as to the identity of Jesus. Just seeing a resurrected person mightn't do that for you. But having spent 3 years with him, where he kept doing weird things, that you and your other friends kept saying, who is this guy that even the wind and the waves obey him? Who is this man who thinks he can forgive sins when only God can forgive sins? Who is this man? And finally Thomas goes, that's who you are. You're God living amongst us as a human being. So for Thomas, that's the last piece that puts it together for him. That he's not just dealing with a great religious man, a fine moral teacher, but he's dealing with God who became one of us to deal with our most pressing problems.
I'd like to open up for questions, comments or discussion issues, and Ian can talk a bit more.
Okay. Any statements, observations, queries? It's a strange thing people say about bias, isn't it? Because, I mean, I alluded to South Sydney, which is a rugby league team I've been supporting since I was little. I've been to matches when they've won, and I've been to matches when they've lost. And although I'm hopelessly biased, I can tell you what happened, basically. Now, I've got a friend who supports Balmain, and one year in the grand final, Balmain beat South. They shouldn't have. In fact, it was a disgrace. And I'm sure the referee wasn't keeping the other team back the full 5 metres. But you can argue about various, but the details are right. And I think people are strange on the question of bias. They just need to think about it more, because you can be thoroughly invested in something but still tell the truth. And one of the things that most people discover when they become a Christian is one of the struggles is to become truthful. I was a very good liar before I became a Christian. And the only reason I stopped lying was because of the teaching of the early Christians. Because they very clearly portray Jesus as someone who does not believe that you only tell the truth when you've said an oath, but every word you speak should be truthful. So yeah, I think it is, and we need to help people see that. Of course, I mean, I think it's science is the most helpful one. You know, someone argues a case, of course they're persuaded. The question is, look at the evidence. Anyway, yes, I think I agree. Any other points or questions? Yes, and that's the area where I think longer conversations, you know, are more helpful. I think it is. There are all sorts of untruths that get said without even thinking in various areas of business. Even, you know, I'll get back to you tomorrow, or that, or the thing I get irritated by, because having watched my father who ran a shop, and who wasn't a Christian until later in life, but if he said, "I will get that by tomorrow," he got it by tomorrow, even if it meant either me riding on my push bike miles and miles to a drug house to get it, or if they didn't have it, my mother getting in the car and driving even further, because the old man had the view that if you say you're going to do something, you do it. And I think that sort of old world view of truthfulness is rarer and rarer. I think that certainly it's an area where Christians are locked into a God who believes in truth and believes that we should speak the truth. Our words should be trustworthy. Most products that, I don't know if you're involved in selling, but most products that if we're involved in selling, if the product's half good, we can say lots of good things about it. You mightn't just want to oversell it. But my understanding with people is if they sell truthfully, long term, they do well. Because people are often desperately trying to find someone who'll be truthful to them. So the profits are probably less in the first year but longer in the 10. Here's a little question for you to think about. Into which category does Jesus belong? I'll just give you two groups of people. Buddha, Florence Nightingale, Joseph Stalin, Mao Zedong, Ben Chifley, or Julia Gillard, Muhammad Ali, Nelson Mandela. Now, I want to suggest to you, Jesus belongs in the second category, because they're all alive. And one of the things which they're all alive. You see, one of the things which is very hard for us not to think of Jesus as just one of the great dead men. But he's not. He is a contemporary. He's knowable and meetable. When I used to work in the city, long before I now work back in the city, I worked in the city some years ago. And a guy rang me up and said, "Ian, can I come and have a cup of coffee with you?" I said, "Sure." And he was our church treasurer at the church I was going to. And he said, "A terrible thing happened to me on Sunday in church." I said, "What?" He said, "It was one of these churches where they say a creed. Not all churches do that, where they say, 'I believe in God, the Father, the Almighty Maker.'" And he got to the point where it said, he was crucified, dead and buried. On the third day, he rose from the dead. And he said, it was like someone slapped him across the back of the head. And he suddenly went, my God, he's alive. He really is alive. And he was horrified by this because he'd never realized that Jesus was alive. He was a contemporary. He'd conquered death. And his worry was that everyone in the church would be angry with him. I said, no, I think you'll find everyone in church would be delighted for you. But I'm not suggesting he wasn't a Christian. But I just think he'd never got the fact that Jesus was not a great man of the past, but had risen never to die again. And something remarkable happened in Jerusalem about 33 AD. And I had a debate, and I'm about to sit down after this. I had a debate some years ago with a man who was head of the Australian Skeptics Association then. He's now the editor of their magazine. And Martin and I went up to Springwood and we had a debate about the resurrection. And I'd been pressing all the way through, what do you make of the missing body and these people who said they saw him and then were willing to die for their statement simply that they saw him? I was pushing him and pushing him. We were argy-barging, all the fun and games of a debate. And as we were getting into our cars at the end, I said, Martin, what do you think happened that started Christianity? He said, I've never thought about it. I said, well, that was what the whole debate was about. But I think to ask, that's the question. How do we explain the missing body and this small group of insignificant men and women who just couldn't be shut up about the fact that death had actually met its match in Jesus, and they knew it because they'd seen him? And that I think is what the thing that sort of keeps pursuing and pushing people to believe in it when they look at the evidence. Evidence is very unconvincing if you don't look at it. But when you start to look at the evidence for the resurrection, that's when it becomes sort of powerful and interesting. I think there are copies of John's Gospel. If you'd like to take one or one of the Gospels just to read it for yourself, it's in a pocket size so you can sort of take it on the tram or whatever way you travel in this city. Thank you for having me here.